We've got a real treat coming up on This Week in Law. We've got Orrick Herrington's Neil Chatterjee. He's a patent expert, and we're going to talk about patent reform, the Supreme Court's recent intellectual property fascination, Let a Thousand Flappy Birds Bloom, embedding Getty images, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 249, recorded March 7, 2014. Release the Flappy Kraken. Hey, folks, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're thrilled that you've joined us this week. We've got an excellent guest. He is Neil Chatterjee, the co-chair of one of the most renowned Silicon Valley law firms, Orrick Herrington. Great to have you here, Neil.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is very, very cool.
It's Appreciate it. Very, very cool. Very, very cool to have you. Neil is mostly a patent lawyer, but as co-chair of the IP department at his firm. I'm sure, Neil, you have your hands in all sorts of different tech and IP kinds of issues.
I do. I do all kinds of weird internet stuff. I do trade secrets disputes when one company loses another, lose a whole bunch of employees to go to another company. I've litigated the question of, can you sell a duck on eBay? All sorts of different weird things like that. When someone says something that another person doesn't like online, I often get pulled in to have to deal with that. Even dealt with problems associated with kids posting stuff and ended up in juvenile hall.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, we want to run through some of your internet greatest hits cases in a minute. But first, I want to introduce my co-host, Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. Hope your Friday's going well. It's good to be here. Neil, nice to meet you. Really looking forward to our conversation.
Nice to meet you, Evan.
So tell us about ducks on eBay. It seems like that would have been a terms of service violation that someone was engaged in.
So I've been doing internet stuff since 1993, before they named the internet formally. And this was in the very early days of eBay, in 1997, 98, 98 timeframe. And back then, nobody knew about these terms of service rules. Nobody knew what people could do online or not do online. And eBay was becoming really popular. It was started because a guy wanted to sell Pez dispensers for his wife. And then everyone started selling everything. People were trying to sell votes online. They were trying to sell their virginity online. They were selling all kinds of things through eBay. And I happened to be down there. They had 1.5 lawyers, a person that worked part-time, and then a person that had just been hired. One of those guys, he kind of looked like a Canadian Mountie, kind of walked in. And he was from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and handed a subpoena and said, you know, someone's selling a duck on eBay, and I'm not sure that people can do that. And everyone back then kind of shrugs their shoulders. I don't know what people can sell on eBay and what they can't. And so now the terms of service are pretty clearly defined, and whether a company like eBay would be liable is pretty well defined. But back then, nobody really knew. And so we dealt with a lot of lawsuits early in eBay's history about what are kind of the rules of the road. And a lot of the early rules about what people should or should not sell on eBay were actually they were drafted by eBay, but we played a pretty heavy role in helping come up with those rules of the road. Today, they have a huge in-house legal department that does all that stuff. But in the early days, you know, it was trying to figure it out as we go along.
Was Jay Monahan there for the duck?
Yeah, and actually, Jay's a really close friend of mine. No, he was not there for the duck. He was hired about 2 years later. Jay became a very good friend of mine through working with eBay, and has remained a good friend of mine even in his retirement when he's decided to become a sommelier in Paris or something.
Yes, I enjoy following his Facebook lately because he looks like he's having a heck of a time. He's been on our show before. Maybe sometime we can have you both on. That would be a good fun way to have you guys tell war stories from back in the day.
Yeah, that'd be cool. That'd be cool. I miss Jay, actually.
Yeah. So it's interesting that eBay went through all that. And now I guess people just, you know, if they had a duck for sale, they would put it on Craigslist.
Probably, or some other, maybe there's, you know, a livestock business to business commerce website or something. But
right.
I'm sure there are lots of places where one can buy livestock today online.
Yeah, that's more of a dark web kind of thing, I imagine. You really got to go way underground to get your livestock, depending on what your predilections are. But I would imagine there's something out there, right?
Stay away from the guy looking for goats aggressively.
Good advice all around. So tell us, you were telling us before the show that you're... profile pic on LinkedIn has you in a Viking helmet with a huge can of spam. Tell us about what prompted that picture.
So a number of years ago, I was dealing with a lot of online spam activities. One of the weird internet things that I do is getting involved in digital crime and digital activity that's kind of the sketchy variety. One thing that a lot of clients hire me for is to stop spammers or people who are kind of abusing their computer systems. And we had one guy who had basically come up with a spam campaign on Facebook, and we were able to secure an $860 million judgment against him. And at the time, it was a really, really big decision. So when I was doing the spam work, a local newspaper said they were going to write an article about some of the interesting things that I was doing, one of the legal newspapers. And, you know, typically when people take pictures of lawyers, they all kind of have the same dark suit and they cross their arms and they try and do the camera looking up so they look ominous into it. And I instead said, you know, I'm kind of an irreverent guy. So I got a can of spam and a Viking hat. And on the cover of this newspaper was a picture of me looking absolutely stunned and looking at the spam can. And they took a picture and put it on the cover of the newspaper. So then I took that picture and I put it on my LinkedIn page.
Love it. It's great when lawyers don't take themselves too seriously. And it seems like, you know, much as I got to say, I have this prejudice against big firms sometimes where I think that in order to make equity partner or certainly co-chair the intellectual property department at a firm like Oryk, you might have to have a good dose of Frank Underwood in you. But I think you're changing my mind about that, Neil. So that's great.
So Denise, I don't know. I don't think you're a friend of mine on Facebook. I friend almost anyone who friends me. So I lose a little bit of track. But I actually have a section on my Facebook page in the notes section for the Maximum Awesomeness Practice Group, or the MAPG. and we have our guiding principles, and they include important things like eat as much bacon as you can. So in our group, a little bit of irreverence is key.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's get into what's going on in the world of patent, your specialty, because it's super interesting right now. And both in Washington and the Supreme Court, things are kind of heating up.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some bills that are pending. Patent reform has obviously been on many people's minds. There is a bill that's been pending in the Senate. A new one was just introduced. Can you bring us up to speed there? And what's your best guess on where the Senate bills are going?
Yeah, so I think kind of the message of the day, right, is that change is a coming, but we just don't know from where. There are kind of a number of kind of key components that are being debated about in the Senate and the House, in the courts, in the FTC, in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, in the White House, that are all kind of directed at kind of solving aspects of the same problems. The most recent bill that's been introduced is really to improve the transparency. What people are really getting at is patent trolls normally are shell companies. They don't have any employees. They don't have they're often just a name on the door and nothing more than that. And then they're held by people that kind of hide in the shadows in the background because they don't want to be tagged as being patent trolls necessarily. And they also want to insulate themselves from liability. And so one of the things that people are trying to do is saying, look, if you want to form a shell company, that's fine, but you're not allowed to hide your identity, because if you're a scumbag or a very bad person or just a shakedown artist, the world is entitled to know who you are. And this is important, because there are some companies that will find themselves in literally hundreds of patent troll lawsuits. And if they knew who's kind of pulling the strings in the background, they might decide to fight or not fight, depending on who the people in the background really are. Because sometimes you want to send a message, and sometimes you just want a problem to go away and avoid expense. But that transparency is becoming a very important issue. Once you have that transparency, you then start being faced with the question of, well, should I put those people on the hook too if they're just bringing meritless claims to shake people down? But that's really what some of the new stuff is getting at, is really to improve the transparency of who's shaking who down, how are they doing it, constraining what they can say and requiring them to say certain things, and then really trying to make sure there's a little more accountability in the process.
So this is Senator McCaskill's bill, co-sponsored by Senator Rockefeller. And one of the things it would do, as you've been discussing, Neil, is to allow the FTC more leeway to require when folks are sending out demand letters that they're going to have to disclose more about themselves. Can you kind of outline how you see that playing out?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a couple things that the bill requires. The first thing is you can't just say, people do this all the time. They send hundreds of letters out saying, you know, I have a patent, give me a pile of money. And now it's requiring people to be much more specific in what their accusation is, to say who are the patent's owners and where are they located, how can you find them, and what's going on with respect to the patent. It's really, the goal is to make it much more transparent. And then if people are really kind of bending the rules too much, I forgot to mention this earlier, it's putting some hammers in place where there can be fines for not being precise or clear enough. There can be attorney general actions that are now authorized to let state attorney generals to target this kind of shakedown behavior. And it's really to deal with the very specific aspect of patent trolling, which is sending out lots of letters to create fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the marketplace.
Right. So you think that if people are required to disclose that they're a non-practicing entity, or that they are, you know, basically a P.O. box in East Texas somewhere, that people might be more inclined to not roll over when they receive these letters?
Either not roll over. I would say that's one piece of the information, because there's also other pieces of information they have to give. Mm-hmm. But what it does is it makes the patent troll, if it is a patent troll, have to work much harder in setting forth a credible theory of infringement with really strong consequences if they're just trying to shake people down. And also, it will help people know what's the nature of this troll and what's going on with these patents in a way that will try and create more accountability, so some people can think twice. Because like any kind of legal dispute, you know, for companies that receive thousands of these letters, they're trying to figure out what's the threat matrix on this. Is this a big deal? Is it a small deal? Or is it someone just trying to shake me down? And this type of information will make that a lot more accessible.
Well, it seems like a good idea to me. It also seems kind of unprecedented. Evan, can you think of another area of the law where someone sending out a cease and desist or a demand letter has various FTC compelled disclosures they have to make, or other federal agency compelled disclosures?
Well, no, I mean, nothing precisely on point like this, but we do see plaintiffs being regulated at a consumer sort of level. I'm thinking of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. I'm sure we could probably draw some some, you know, map over a few points where there are similarities there to kind of protect the recipients of mean letters. It's an interesting phenomenon, though, the what we see here, because a lot of the justifications for the changes that are going on here, you know, the increase in transparency, the requirements that patent assertion entities come up with more information. This seems something very specific to the litigation phenomenon, or at least the threat, the invitation to license phenomenon that we're seeing here. And it's hard to figure out how that it has a basis or a justification from the intellectual property perspective, the underlying intellectual property law that's looking to be addressed here, whether that be, you know, whether the claims be meritorious or not. So that's what seems to be the most interesting thing to me about it, is how we've seen trolls behave badly. So there's this response here, these based on the ideology that patent trolling is bad, sort of managing the way that plaintiffs and senders of these letters are supposed to be. It's sort of interesting, isn't it, to think, you know, that it really doesn't relate to the intellectual property issue. It's just kind of the practice that has risen up around it. That's what's interesting to me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, one quick question. Do you think it's going to be, I mean, obviously they're not going to have to put a whole complaint into a letter that is calculated to do away with the need to file a complaint, but they're going to have to come up with some kind of legal substance in these letters should this bill pass.
Yeah, they're going to have to come up with some, you know, articulable basis to assert infringement, more than just saying you have a product that's on the internet or something like mm-hmm. that.
Right.
And so, you know, I think there probably will be some fights that happen if this bill's passed about what's the level of specificity required, what actually has to go in there, what kind of investigation needs to go into writing such a letter. None of those things are really defined right now. I did want to make one comment about your previous question, which is, we do have one instance that I can think of where there's something kind of like this. Mm-hmm. And the instance is notifications under the DMCA. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, because in those instances, right, you have somebody that's sending a letter to an internet service provider saying, hey, some of my copyright stuff is on your system and you need to block it or take it down.
Right.
And the way that the case law is developing in that area is they're saying, look, when you're a copyright holder, you actually have to do things like analysis of fair use. And you have to make sure that you have a good faith basis to send some kind of a DMCA request. Otherwise, there are kind of dire consequences, not through the FTC or state attorney general, but for sending an incorrect DMCA notice. So it's a little bit different, but it does have some degree of similarity.
So in keeping with our theme of patent as political football these days, the White House has its own proposals that it's putting forth. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so the White House is doing a bunch of different things. And like I said, there's all these different people that all agree that patent trolling is a problem, and they're all kind of struggling to figure out what's the right way to go. And they're all kind of racing on how to deal with things. So the first thing, and I think this is by far the most interesting thing, is the crowdsourcing idea, where they are talking about allowing crowdsourcing for searching for prior art, the kind of technical information that might predate a patent that would invalidate it. And they're talking about doing certain executive functions and adjustments to the USPTO that would allow for that kind of activity. That's I think that's the big one. That's a really, really creative idea. It's similar to you know, kind of what Adam Carolla is trying to do, but on a governmental level, which is interesting. The next thing that they're doing is they're increasing the training in the USPTO, really about that as it relates to what's called functional claiming. And functional claiming is a way to write a patent claim based upon what something does, rather than what it is. And there's a big debate in the law about when and how it's appropriate to do functional claiming. And a lot of patent troll activity is really driven by functional claiming. So the White House is trying to put in place some measures to really make it a much more restrictive approach to make sure people aren't gaming the system to just draft these very broad, functionally written claims. The next, I'm trying to think what all of the different criteria are. Those were the two that I can think of off the top of my head. I'm sure there are a couple other major ones, but those are the ones that kind of get the most attention. Is really cracking down on functional claiming and the crowdsourcing idea. I can't remember off the top of my head if the executive order also included having more transparency also with respect to patent troll letters and the like.
It sounds like the natural effect of both of those things, the crowdsourcing to presumably find more prior art that wouldn't be discovered otherwise, and this emphasis on functional claiming, it seems like that the end result would be fewer patents issued. Is that too simple of an extrapolation to make from this?
I wouldn't say it would necessarily mean fewer patents being issued. It might mean that people are going to be held to the fire a little bit more to draft more specific claims or more specific claims directed towards what something, how something is actually built, rather than it's kind of its market utility in some ways. It is directed towards curbing, you know, some of the types of claims that seem to be the biggest problems in the patent troll world. So it could reduce the number. I think it's more likely to narrow the scope of them.
So a couple of other aspects of the White House's approach here is they have, I'm not sure if this is the White House or the Patent Office. The EFF is reporting on the White House changes, though, and talking about the Patent Office now having a toolkit that's called Been Sued or Gotten a Demand Letter that has a bunch of best practices and resources for businesses and individuals who are facing a threat of a patent suit, perhaps from a patent troll. The other things that EFF highlights are that the patent office personnel will have more training for the examiners and also more educational tools for people who have been sued, pro bono and pro se assistance, giving people resources to seek free counsel and have more resources if they want to represent themselves to become educated about patent claims. That's a pretty tough road, especially given that the patent bar has its own bar exam that people pass in order to be able to practice in that area. It's not something that a pro se litigant should take on lightly, is it, Neil?
Yeah, well, so there's two kinds of pro se activities. One is activities in front of the patent office. And the activities in front of the patent office, you have to pass the patent bar. There's a lot of really complicated rules, and you have to have a very specialized understanding. The other one, if you're just going into court, it can be any practicing lawyer, and you can represent yourself. But again, there's a lot of highly specialized rules when you're going into a court that, you know, even though you don't have a patent bar license, and people do the patent litigation, I do that, and I'm not patent bar certified, but it's still really complicated, a very foreign process. I guess my issue with that piece of it, I think it's always good for the government to give more information and guidance to people, is I just don't think people will necessarily know where to find that information. When someone's sued in a lawsuit, I'm not sure it would be their first instinct to say, hey, I was just sued in a lawsuit. I'm going to go to the patent office. And so these educational resources are great, and I really encourage them. I'm not sure they'll be as impactful as some of the other things that the White House is doing.
I guess it just depends on how good the government is, the federal government is with their SEO, right? Because most people just do a Google search on this stuff. And if the patent office stuff comes up high, it'll be a resource.
Right. You know, it might be nice if the local court systems that are seeing a lot of these patent cases, like the Eastern District of Texas or Delaware or something, had a link on their website, because people do tend to go look at, you know, the local court's website or whatever when they've been sued someplace. And that might drive more traffic and let the information get out better.
Let's talk about the crowdfunding or crowdsourcing piece for a moment. We're talking about, you know, letting people contribute their ideas and their insights to finding prior art on patents. There have been a couple of projects that have gone that way in the past, but never something institutionalized with the patent office. Is that right?
Yeah, I've never seen something institutionalized like this.
Yeah. So that seems like a great idea. And then I said a moment ago, crowdfunding instead of crowdsourcing. Is there a piece of that too, or is it more sort of tapping the community's knowledge?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I think it's mainly crowdsourcing with various kinds of rewards built in. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that Corolla is doing, which is outside the government, obviously, is more crowdfunding. And there's an element of it that's crowdsourcing, but I think there is some element of going to the community and having a reward, but I don't know exactly how that funding plays out, and I'm not sure there is a definitive decision on that.
Right. You were on his show back, what was it, November or December last year?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. Talking about the litigation that he is facing in East Texas, he and his show, his company, on this so-called podcasting patent. Do you know if there have been any developments there?
There hasn't been a lot of, well, I kind of follow it just, you know, kind of like everybody else does. It's just kind of an interesting thing. And if you listen to the show, you know, it's something that's clearly on his mind. Mm-hmm. You know, these cases, very little happens for a long period of time. In the Eastern District of Texas, you typically show up for a status conference and there's very little that happens in court until there's a specific hearing where the judge tries to explain what the meaning of particular patent claim terms are, called a Markman hearing. I don't think there's been any major developments there. I know that there was a reexamination request filed, and I have not checked on the status of that lately. And I know that that the Corolla Show has been running this fund to try and get some money to develop an evidentiary record or some sort of record to kill these patents.
Right. As someone and involved with a network who is involved in the same kinds of activities that Adam is, this is near and dear to our heart. So I wasn't able to quickly find, you know, I know he wanted to get a legal defense kind of fund going, and I'm not quickly coming up with the link to where that is. So if anyone in IRC can point me to that, we'll mention it here on the show before we get too much further on. Let's talk about Keurig for a second. This seems to be a patent-related issue. If anyone, you know, I don't know if coffee purists out there think these Keurig things are just kind of too convenient and awful to tolerate, but they're certainly successful and they're certainly easy and fast and, in my opinion, make a fine cup of coffee. I'm particularly a fan of their espresso machine that they came out with not too long ago. But hearkening back to some cases in the past about printer cartridges, printer ink, and garage door openers, it seems like Green Mountain, who has the license to make these Keurig K-Cups, doesn't want other people in that game. And the expiration of a patent back in 2012 seems to have allowed the flourishing of these various competitors to Green Mountain in the K-Cup field. But now Green Mountain is trying to lock that down. Do you have any take on this at all, Neil?
Yeah. So, you know, these are what are called razor blade industries, right? Where, you know, you you can talk about in terms of printers and cartridges, razor blades. And now it looks like coffee and K-cups. You know, I think this is an interesting case. You know, it's is escaping me at the moment. I don't remember how all of there were a number of HP cases that were around and they went very, very, I think they might have even gone to the Supreme Court, around the printer ink cartridges. But I think this one's a little bit of a tough unfair competition market, because, you know, the solution or unfair competition or antitrust claim, because really, you know, people could go and buy a different device, or they could just use a normal coffee maker in their house. And the big issue to me is I've bought a lot of coffee makers over the years where they had some specialized filter of some sort. And I think that was pretty common, that you'd go to the store and there'd be four or five different kinds of filters, and there'd also be the generic ones. And that never really seemed to present much of an antitrust or competitiveness problem. And the fact that they're now putting in, you know, some sort of DRM to make sure it's an authorized one, you know, I don't see why they're not allowed to do that, as long as they notify consumers that that's what they're doing.
Right. It'll be interesting to see this play out, because I know there is a lot of competition in this field. But Evan, you're just too busy drinking the gourmet Tonks coffee to worry about any of this, aren't you?
That's right. I'm much too highbrow, but I can peer over and to see what the proletariat are doing with their K-cups and examine all this. So, and what a lightning rod issue we have here. It's like, come on, Keurig, you know, you get everybody hooked on your product, and just, you know, really, you know, fortify the caffeine addiction that everybody has. And then you go and pull a stunt like this using DRM. What a, you know, like I said, what a lightning rod issue here. So what a great scenario, factual context to reinvigorate people talking about DRM, and by extension, the DMCA, Section 1201, Section 1202, you know, the anti-circumvention provisions. This harkens to the like we were talking about. I think, Neil, I mean, you said HP. Maybe you're thinking of the Lexmark cases. I don't know the relationship between Lexmark and HP, if there is one. But I know it all, you know, down in Kentucky in the Sixth Circuit, there's been litigation I think may even still be ongoing on some issues. It's been going on probably 10 years or more about, you know, whether or not it's appropriate for, you know, microchip technology to allow certain printer cartridges to be used in certain models of printers. There was some litigation about 10 years ago involving Chamberlain, the garage door opener technology here in the Seventh Circuit, that you know, and evaluated some similar issues. So I think what's lurking behind all of these discussions is this question of, you know, is the new form of liability, and by new I say since 1998, we're looking at a long view of history here, you know, the new form of liability that came about when the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA were enacted, is this the scenario that is appropriate for that liability to be put in place here? Because ostensibly the idea was that the anti-circumvention provisions were geared to protect means of access and means of copying of copyright protected works. And so I guess the theory is here that the DRM and this is where I'm just extrapolating. I haven't looked into, you know, the particulars of what Keurig has to do here, but conceivably the remedy for circumventing or, you know, hacking your new Keurig machine so that it didn't work here, the remedy would be, among other things, a violation of the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA. So the question then becomes, you know, is that how we want things to be governed? Is that the mechanism? Is it really copyright that should step in and serve as a set of remedies, you know, to provide a set of remedies and impose obligations on the consumer in this context? So with a popular brand like Keurig and a popular consumer product like coffee, if this thing goes forward as what we're hearing, it could really lead to some pretty provocative discussions about anti-circumvention and DRM and the DMCA in general.
Yeah, I think you can also look at it as in addition to the DMCA Section 1201 issues, as kind of based in some of these computer trespass statutes, you know, like Computer Fraud and Abuse Act or California Penal Code 502C or various things that are really directed towards, you know, stopping hacking types of activity. But, you know, the issue there is would someone that bought a coffee maker really kind of think that that Keurig still had a proprietary interest in controlling the stuff that was going on their coffee makers? And how do you navigate that as far as ensuring that licenses and restrictions on use were somehow meaningfully understood?
Mm-hmm. And that plays into, I think, the assumption that most people have is when you buy something, e.g. a coffee maker, it's yours and you should be free to do with it as you want. And there's a certain real built-in, you know, hardwired disdain that people seem to have for that. Or at least last time I checked, that seems to kind of be a public sentiment. Maybe folks in IRC can correct me if now we're all good with, you know, having locked down products that we use and have no real freedom to tinker, as the expression goes in Ed Felton's blog title, goes in there. It really seems to touch a nerve.
Yeah, let me look that up on my iPad, and I'll get back to you on that, Evan.
You're gonna use Firefox on your iPad or something like that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I do think you're both raising excellent points on this, and it'll be interesting to see where this goes. It's like you say, Neil, it's just sort of the latest in a longstanding theme of people attempting to keep intellectual property control over aspects of their product that I think the general public thinks should be more open and interactive. So, given that we've had so many interesting IP issues to discuss, even just in this first part of the show, I think it's interesting to point out, and Neil pointed out to me before the show, that, let's see, what was the stat you sent over? That the United States Supreme Court has more intellectual property cases on its docket this year than it's ever had in one term since the 19th century. So that's definitely indicative of, I think, the political nature and the high profile nature of IP issues just in the public awareness these days. Neil, you want to bring us up to speed as to what some of those cases are?
Well, so one of them actually ties in pretty closely to one of the legislative reforms on patent law that's underway. And the real question is at what point do you look at a case and say, you know, this case really was meritless, and the court will say, I'm going to award attorney's fees. And the case at the Supreme Court is actually a trademark case. But the way that the legal analysis applies is the same for both trademark and copyright. Trademark and patent cases. And the bar was really, really high for these sorts of cases to find something exceptional and to award attorney's fees. And what the legislation underway is to really create bigger hammers on fee shifting. What the Supreme Court was confronted with is really what is the right standard that one should apply in order to determine when an award of attorney's fees is warranted. That's the first case, and it's a big one, because if the Supreme Court reduces the burden on a defendant, for example, on seeking an award of attorney's fees, that's a big hammer to disincentivize patent trolls from going forward. Or other people from lodging kind of meritless patent claims, because you can get an attorney's fees award. The next case that's going up there is the Limelight case. Excuse me. And the Limelight case is interesting because many people would argue that the Federal Circuit, which is the appellate court handling patent disputes, created essentially a new cause of action for indirect infringement. And the way that indirect infringement works is I may not infringe a patent, but I might teach someone else to infringe a patent. And if I teach someone else to infringe a patent, then when I do that, I am inducing their behavior. And the question that the Federal Circuit was confronted with was, if there's no indication that someone has actually done the direct infringement. They haven't actually conducted things in a way where actual direct infringement was occurring. Could someone still be on the hook for teaching someone to do it? So to try to make a metaphor to our normal daily lives, if I were to write a book about how to kill somebody, but no one actually read that book and acted upon it, would I still be liable for some sort of crime just because I wrote a book about how to kill somebody? And the Federal Circuit said you can have a claim for indirect infringement, induced infringement, even if there's no indication of direct infringement. And they actually skirted over the issues that were originally presented to them. This was considered a really big deal in the patent world, that it was really creating essentially a new cause of action. And the Supreme Court's addressing whether the law actually requires an indication that somebody's actually done the so-called bad deed that would cause infringement, or would it not? Or can you just be liable for this indirect theory? In the patent troll context, this is a really big deal because many patent trolls sue based upon internet activity where you have a client and a server talking to each other. And that indirect infringement claim ends up being a very significant part of the litigation. There's some additional bells and whistles around how you find infringement there, but fundamentally, that's kind of what they, what that case is about. I'm trying to pull up my list right now on the other several cases. There's one that I can't talk about because we have some involvement in it called Nautilus. Which gets at some of these functional claiming issues that we chatted about.
Right. I've got your list here. We've got the Highmark and Octane Fitness cases, Limelight you mentioned, Nautilus you just mentioned. We've got Aereo, which we'll talk about in a little while here.
And Octane Palm, is the attorney sheeting.
Yes. Palm Wonderful LLC, that's... whether the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act precludes certain claims under the Lanham Act. Alice Corp, which is about patent eligibility of software-related patent claims. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, that's a big one. The Alice Corp one is, there's a big debate over... what is actually patentable and when does something move from just being an idea to actually be something concrete and implemented in a way that the government should award a patent right to people. And it's called a Section 101 problem because Section 101 of the Patent Act specifies what you can and cannot patent. And the CLS appeal is really directed towards a particular type of computer-implemented method and whether or not just implementing things that someone could do with a pen and a paper could be considered patentable where someone can get a patent and assert it against other people. This is a really big deal in the patent troll community because Section 101 fights are now happening almost as a matter of course in these cases. Last time the Supreme Court was confronted with the question, it was a case called In Re Bilski. And in In Re Bilski, they issued an opinion and said, sure, the Federal Circuit has a test, and that test is one useful test, but we're not going to give a whole lot of guidance as to whether that's the only useful test, as to whether certain kinds of software patents are patentable. And instead, we'll leave it to the appellate courts or the Federal Circuit to decide. Since then, you have Federal Circuit cases that come out all over the map on what are the ground rules for these business method kind of types of patent claims. And CLS is now trying to come up with a better framework for what's protectable and what's not on these Section 101 grounds. It's a big anti-patent troll case. Tons of people have submitted amicus briefs.
Right. So we will keep an eye on that one and the rest of this flurry of IP cases on the Supreme Court's docket this term. Let's see. It's Me in IRC came up with a good comment to our discussion. Would not all teaching give skills which are capable of infringing patents? So I guess there's a policy argument someone could throw in. We can't allow patent trolls to shut down the entire education system. If we did learn from IRC, thank you, whoever gave me this link, where Adam Carolla's crowdfund effort is, it's at fundanything.com/patent troll. And they've raised $77,577 to date. So that's really impressive. And if you head on over there, you can learn more about that campaign. I think now would be a good time, too, to drop in an MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Let's make it K-Cups in honor of our discussion of those fine creations. We drop these passphrases into the show if you're listening for continuing legal education credit in your jurisdiction, and someone wants to have you demonstrate that you actually listen to or watch the show. You can tell them, yep, I know the secret phrases. The first one for this episode is K-Cups. If you want more information about getting continuing legal education or other professional credit for listening to or watching This Week in Law, head on over to the Twit Wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Go to our show page, and we've got a bunch of information there. And with your permission, gentlemen, let's shift gears and talk about some copyright issues.
I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
Good, good.
Same here.
So about a month ago was when we went through all the drama with Flappy Bird getting pulled from the Android and iTunes app stores. About a month down the road here, it's kind of ironic that, you know, it was never really 100% confirmed that it was some sort of Nintendo pressure on the app creator that because the game resembled Mario Brothers with its green pipes, that urged him to back down and not continue to market the game or even make the game available. I think the owner claims he never marketed the game at all. It just became very virally popular. But whether or not there was some sort of Nintendo pressure coming to bear, what was one game that had a vague resemblance to Mario Brothers is now more than 800 Flappy Bird clones still out there. I know what I'm seeing just sort of anecdotally as I watch kids play is, you know, how fun it is for them to find their favorite Flappy Bird clone and share it with each other. You know, have you tried this one? No, here, try this one. So there's been a flourishing of Flappy Bird clones that if in fact there was some sort of Nintendo bias against the game, this hasn't improved the situation. There are more green pipes out there than ever, although a lot of the games I've noticed are getting away from the green pipe motif and finding something else for the little protagonist in the game to fly over. So it's sort of a perhaps Streisand effect kind of example, because whereas there was one Flappy Bird, now we've got going on 1,000 of them. Neil, what do you make of all this?
Well, you know, game cloning, especially in the app world, there's nothing new there, right? I mean, there's always going to be new fun game mechanics, and when someone finds something cool, there's always going to be 10,000 other versions. I mean, you see that even in the movie industry, right? Some movie with vampire teenagers come out, and all of a sudden you have 15 other movies with vampire teenagers. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, the issues associated with copycat games is really, really challenging. And the reason that it's challenging is it's hard to draw the line between what is actually copyrightable and what is like a game mechanic. You know, Flappy Bird has a couple attributes to it that really make it a highly addictive game. But that isn't really creative expression. That's really a functional characteristic of the game. And I think it's really interesting that once people lock on to a functional characteristic that's really fun, that, you know, everyone's going to try and replicate different versions of the same sorts of mechanics. And how you protect that and how you deal with it It's a pretty controversial thing going back 30 years, back to the days of video games like Frogger.
Lawwall in IRC throws the comment trade dress into the discussion. Do you think that comes into play here when we're talking about games?
You know, I've asserted trade dress claims in cases like this before. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you have to look at how confusingly similar the imagery is in the trade dress claims. So I'll give an example just using the Frogger one. In the Frogger game, the original Frogger game, you had a frog crossing the road and all these cars and other things going across different lanes. Well, at the same time, in the other part of the world, someone came up with a game about a chicken crossing a road, and it was a chicken with different looking cars and different looking things kind of getting in the way on the road, but the chicken was still trying to cross the road. Now, while a frog may taste like chicken, there's really no other similarity between those games other than the pure mechanic of trying to cross a road with a number of moving obstacles. I don't think that one would have had a trade dress claim because people wouldn't look at the game and say, you know, wow, that looks a lot like the Frogger game from a visual perspective, just a mechanical perspective. If you could do that, you could say, well, you know, Burger King and McDonald's both make hamburgers. And because I can buy fast food hamburgers from both places, there's a trade dress problem. That wouldn't work under the law.
Evan, what do you think about all these clones out there?
Well, it gets us down to this really, either gets us down there or gets us up to this difficult metaphysical question that is presented in copyright of the idea expression dichotomy. You know, what is something that is going to be protectable by copyright in as much as it is actually a creative expression of something rather than just the ideas or the method or the process that's underlying it. And a lot of this seems to have to do with just how it's articulated. It probably has a lot of it to do with good advocacy, whether or not one can convince a finder of fact that something truly is an expression rather than just the idea underlying it. And it's hard, certainly by taking a survey over the body of case law that has developed over this stuff over the last however many years, and then going even further back into the history of copyright law with all copyright scholars know of cases like Baker versus Selden, you know, the blank forms doctrine and those types of things going well back into the 19th century. It's hard to really draw bright lines where, you know, to separate those two elements of, in the dichotomy, the idea versus the expression, because we've got wacky things like the decision that came out in 2012 involving Tetris. There was some litigation over a Tetris clone. And if my recollection is right, the Tetris was found in that instance to have remedies against the clone in that situation. But Tetris is, you know, it was copying the functional aspects of it. So anytime we get into situations like this, anytime the factual context puts us into the idea expression dichotomy, it's one of those things where you've really got to, think, you know, really approach it from an abstract point of view and really expect to challenge yourself mentally getting into the question of what is an expression that will be protected by copyright and what is a mere idea that is going to belong more to the general human intellectual heritage rather than somebody in particular.
Just sort of hypothetically thinking this through, Neil, if Dong Nguyen, the creator of Flappy Bird, decides that he made a mistake here, or maybe this was some sort of strategic decision all along to encourage clones of his popular game to go out there, if he decided all of a sudden he wanted to get litigious about this, do you think, in a game that was clearly trying to be true to the original Flappy Bird and duplicated as closely as possible, do you think he'd have a claim?
I think some creative lawyers could probably come up with a claim, and it would really be driven by how similar does the imagery look in the two games. The pure game mechanic of the experience, I think, is it's very hard to protect. But the closer you get to the expressiveness, the kind of artisticness of the game, the stronger your claims get.
Right. And then maybe Nintendo jumps in as some sort of interested party at some point. as someone in IRC said, is a clone of a clone of a clone of a clone still a clone of the original? So I don't know.
Well, wasn't there a Michael Keaton movie about that in the 80s or 90s? I forget.
It was the one where he's the house dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I forget what that was called, but it was a good show.
Yeah. Let us move on. Speaking of good show, oops. Goodness gracious, what did I just launch?
Sounds like a good show.
Oh, I know what it is. I clicked over to a new tab and Google's little animation that they have up today in honor of International Women's Day started playing. That is a good one if you haven't checked it out yet.
Yeah. Thanks, Alex. But Multiplicity was the film we're talking about. Alex has it on the screen there. Yeah.
Yes. There we go. Let's see. Where was I? Getty Images did something pretty smart. They obviously have a business model designed around having people pay them in order to use their vast library of stock photography. But they've also decided, I guess they acquired one of these, it's called PicScout, one of these web tracking applications that allows you to find your images when they appear online. Rather than trying to use that to go after everyone who is making use in an unauthorized way of Getty Images, what they found, Craig Peters, a senior vice president at Getty, is reported to have told Bloomberg Businessweek, that they've found tens of millions of unauthorized Getty photos, and that instead of looking at that as an issue, they've decided to look at it as an opportunity, and they're making an embed tool available. So just like you can embed a YouTube video, and there are ways that doing that is commercially lucrative to the person who made the video and posted it up, you know, whether it has just the effect of spreading the word or whether there's actually advertising embedded, that's the route that Getty is headed down. They're going to go ahead and let people embed Getty images for non-commercial purposes and take advantage of this rather than try and put an end to it. In fact, this same article at Bloomberg Businessweek points out that Getty has only filed 7 copyright infringement lawsuits in the past 5 years. And of those, 5 were filed just this January. And presumably they're going after unauthorized commercial use of their images, since they seem to think that non-commercial use is okay. So, Neil, do you like this strategy?
Yeah, I do. I do like this strategy. I think, these sorts of, I kind of call this DRM, it's not exactly, but, you know, this sort of technology is really helpful. And I think it allows people to work in ways that are more collaborative and less shakedown feeling. Mm-hmm. And it opens up a whole raft of new monetization options that kind of align copyright holders more with the internet, because, you know, historically they've been quite hateful of each other.
Right. It's great to see something like this come along. Obviously, embedding photos is nothing new. Flickr's been doing it for a long time. And also Flickr integrates with Creative Commons. But to see a big commercial entity like Getty decide that this is the way to go means that there's something to this business model, I think. You agree, Evan?
Well, it could be that there's something to it, or it could just be that it's less expensive than the alternative of sort of being the more formalized copyright troll that Getty has been for years. Denise, you may have run in the situation. Neil, maybe you as well. A lot of, Getty has sent a lot of cease and desist letters and demand letters over the past however long. I know I've dealt with a lot of clients who've received them and, you know, wanting a modest settlement fee, which, you know, usually is in the, about the same dollar range as what Prenda Law would demand for trading a movie by BitTorrent. So, you know, it's just like that nice little economic threshold there where it's going to be cheaper to settle than it is to try to fight it, especially given the heavy-handed remedies that statutory damages afford someone. So, you know, that it's easy. There's some currency for Getty in it to look progressive and like they understand and that they're adopting the way that the technologies that people want to use to share images. And, you know, that's fine. I'm sure they don't not intend to look good and, you know, kind of with it. But at the same time, it's you know, it's clearly going to be something that was motivated by their bottom line. And I suspect that it just had more to do with recognizing that being as aggressive as it was toward non-commercial use wasn't paying off. And so here's just something to fill that the void of no longer doing that.
One of the ways that it may get Getty more business is pointed out in this Bloomberg Businessweek article by, let's see who authored this, Joshua Brustein, who hones in on the non-commercial use aspect and how murky that can get and speculates that perhaps, you know, if you're in one of those gray areas, you would cough up and pay for the images just to buy that certainty. He says, in an internet chock full of self-promotion, obscurity can turn to fame in a matter of moments. What happens when an individual's personal brand or blog becomes a business in and of itself? Unclear. Neil, do you think that non-commercial distinction is going to be difficult to pin down?
I think it's always difficult to pin down. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's always difficult to pin down, particularly, you know, in the way that our digital lives are developing, right? Where, you know, we have iPhones that are a scramble between work-related stuff and personal stuff. You know, I have lots of work colleagues who are friends of mine on Facebook, as well as people that I would never in a million years work with. And you know, how do you define when something's transcending commercial to non-commercial? You know, I don't know. Sometimes I'll put up information in a status update about something that I'm proud of, but I want my friends to see it because they're my friends, and I want my clients to see it because they're my clients. It's hard to say whether that's a commercial or non-commercial use.
Do you think this is going to be troublesome for folks using these embeds, Evan?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's not something that's going to be unique to this situation. We've talked about this before. You know, what is mm-hmm. what does it mean for something to be commercial and something not to be non-commercial? And that's just a consequence of the way that the means of publication on the web, the means of expression, you know, social media, you know, the category of things in which social media fall, the tools that we have, is it just makes it difficult to draw that distinction. There's nothing, you know, there's not a real distinct change in status when you're at work versus not at work anymore. And that's just, I think it's a cultural shift and it's a technological shift as well. So there could be some interesting factual, you know, parsing to be done. And it does play into a recent decision. I know it's in our show notes and I don't want to take us in a direction that you don't want to go to, Denise, but it is relevant to a recent decision from U.S. District Court here in the Northern District of Illinois, talking about the protectability under the Lanham Act for a person's personal brand. There was a recent decision where the court threw out a Lanham Act claim where an employee had claimed that her employer wrongfully accessed her Facebook and Twitter account. And she claimed that messed up her personal brand. And the court said, yeah, there's a protectable interest in your personal brand here. We're not going to let your Lanham Act claim survive because you haven't shown the right kind of damages. But on that issue of whether or not there is this sense of an individual and their online activity having a commercial value, courts, at least one court, and I'm sure there are others in different contexts, are willing to recognize that as a principle.
Yeah, that's a fascinating case. You wrote it up at your blog, Internet Cases, Evan, and I think it's got a lot of nuances to it. Marmont, if that's how you'd say it, versus Susan Friedman Design Group. And one of the things that comes up for me is what happened here is the plaintiff was out from work. She had a brain injury that she suffered in a work-related car accident. So we're getting all kinds of, you know, personal versus work crossover here as she's out in the hospital. And then for some reason, maybe you can shed some light on why the employer decided it was a good idea to access and post to her Facebook and Twitter accounts. Was she engaged in posting things that related to the company and they didn't want that to lapse while she was out, or what was going on here?
Well, I think that's probably something that's within the scope of those things that are genuine issues of material fact that allowed the Stored Communications Act claim to continue to trial. You know, first of all, this happened in 2009. So that we have almost 5 years now of gained familiarity with social media to sort of have a easier hand at talking about these things. But back in 2009, it was much more of a novel idea of what is the commercial, what is a business's what opportunities do business have to capitalize on social media? So there appear to be some disputed facts as to whether or not the employer asked her to set up the Facebook and Twitter accounts. Another thing that makes the facts disputed, or something that a finder of fact needs to sort out rather than a judge on summary judgment, is, you know, she had her usernames and passwords on a spreadsheet that she said was hidden on the computer somewhere, certainly not intended for everybody to use, and I think also printed out in a locked drawer. So there was this question of, you know, whether or not the employer was authorized to do that. The employer, of course, says, you know, hey, this was our thing. We were directing the employee to do this. And so at that level, or on this layer of discussion about the interface between the employee's social media activity and the employer's social media activity, it sounds a little bit like the issues with Noah Kravitz. Remember, we had him on the show a couple of years ago. I forget what his Twitter handle was. Something Dog, right?
Yes.
You know, this whole issue of it involved trade secrets. It involved, you know, the monetary value of a particular Twitter follower. It involved, you know, rights of publicity. And, you know, it's really surprising that there haven't been more disputes, you know, at the employer-employee interface over this. This one from this Northern District of Illinois here has been percolating for several years, and it's already been through a round of summary judgment motions, but it still doesn't, you know, we still don't have a whole lot more clarity on that, so long as there's going to be this non-understanding of what the relationship is between the employee's activity and, you know, how much that's supposed to inure to the benefit of the company.
Right. He's Noah Kravitz with an I on Twitter. And he was sued by his former employer. He's a he was working for a site called Phone Dog. And was blogging for them, and he was sued by his former employer in contending that his Twitter followers were worth $2.50 each, and that he should pay the company that amount for taking them with him when he left, something like that. So yes, dig into the Twill archives and find more on Noah if you are so inclined. We have a bunch of updates and one new Ninth Circuit decision to discuss on the Hollywood and entertainment front. One of them is the Aereo case we alluded to earlier, one of the many pending before the Supreme Court this term, set for oral argument the end of next month. The update in the Aereo case, not that anything has been forthcoming from the Supreme Court yet, but people are filing amicus briefs and things. The partisan issues involved in this case are lining up. April 22nd is when the oral argument is. I'm sure that will be a well-attended one. But the update is that if you're in Denver or Salt Lake, which were two markets that were being serviced by Aereo. Your Aereo service is now no longer available thanks to a district judge in Utah who lined up on the side that Aereo's retransmission was a copyright infringement. So the 10th Circuit now joins those parts of the U.S. where Aereo is not available, and that will remain the case unless the Supreme Court comes in and says otherwise. Neil, have you been following this Aereo case, and do you have any thoughts as it winds toward oral argument in the Supreme Court?
Yeah, you know, this is one where we actually, I just learned this shortly before this. We've submitted an amicus brief, so I probably mm-hmm. shouldn't comment on this one. Mm-hmm. All I'll say is you know, areas on the right of truth and justice everywhere.
All right, that pretty much sums it up. Evan?
Well, you know, I mean, we can temporarily find whatever we can, what value from this injunction that affects those jurisdictions in the 10th Circuit. I trust that I think it's safe to say that come, when will the decisions from the Aereo arguments come out? I mean, if the arguments are in April, the decisions will probably come out sometime in the fall, right? So it seems at that point, whatever it has happened here in the district court's going to be irrelevant. But it underscores, though, the trickiness of this task of figuring out what the transmit clause means, you know, that whole definition of to publicly perform a work. And we've got some really, really smart people disagreeing on what that means. And I suppose the big reason for that is when it was drafted, this was many moons before the technology that affords us to even envision things like Aereo. It was long before that existed. So it's no mystery that there ought to be some difficulty in seeing how the transmit clause of that definition in the Copyright Act should apply here. So I always think that there will be consequences one way or the other, regardless of how the Supreme Court ultimately comes out here. It could mean the end of over-the-air broadcasting as we see it, if the networks hold true to their threats of pulling content away from open access like this, relatively open access like this, or there could be some legislative activity to clarify what this means, what the transmit clause means. So we could, you know, I don't say this lightly, and I try at least 9 times out of 10 to say that something's not of much consequence, but I think that we can say that there could be something watershed that ultimately happens from the way the whole Aereo situation turns out because of this anachronism we're seeing with the law and the way the technology stretches it.
Yeah, according to the Supreme Court, and this I had to look this up too, Evan, they don't have a set time period in which the justices must reach a decision, unlike some other appellate courts around the country. So after oral argument, they're sort of in a limbo state when they know they say on their site, no one knows exactly when a decision will be handed down by the court in an argued case. But they do say that all cases argued during a term of court are decided before the summer recess begins, usually by the end of June. So that would be a pretty quick turnaround if they're arguing the case on April 22nd. We'll have to keep an eye on that and see
what
happens.
Maybe they already know what they're going to say and already have the clerks already have a draft of an opinion, because it was sort of weird that they took this in the first place. And it was weird that Aereo argued to go up there. So who knows? Right. Maybe shouldn't try to read many tea leaves at all based on the past as to what it'll look like.
Okay, a couple of more updates on things we've been following related to copyright law in the entertainment arena. Six Strikes, the copyright alert system, turned one last month. We really don't know too much about it. People, you know, on the CCI side say it's doing a great job against piracy. People, if you go over and read the Torrent Freak story on it, says, you know, we're not seeing any evidence that there's more revenue being generated by the entertainment industry now that this is in place. So it's kind of a wash. We do know that several hundred thousand notices have been sent out, at least by one of the ISPs. So we're still waiting for data, I think, to be able to analyze the efficacy of CCI, but it's 1 year old. Neil, what do you have any take on it?
You know, I haven't had a whole lot of clients come and talk to me about receiving these sorts of notices and how they deal with it. I mean, I think it's a reasonably good idea, and I'm all for figuring out ways to, you know, have people get along when it comes to online activity, given the difficulty. Beyond that, you know, if it seems to be working, you know, I think people should keep doing it. You know, it isn't a situation where I feel like where I hear a lot of clients, you know, saying to me, at least, you know, this is over the top. This is crazy. This is really, you know, killing our business or mm-hmm. making us have to do a lot of stuff.
Well, that's good to know. Evan, have you ever had a client come to you with a copyright alert system notice?
No, nor have yep. in all of the torrenting I do from home gotten one for myself.
that's good.
Right. I'm just kidding about that. Of course, CCI is going to say it's been a good thing, because to say otherwise would be an existential threat to it. You know, if it's ineffective after a whole year, then what's its whole reason for being? Mm-hmm. And so I guess we can step back and look at that and throw stones at it and pick nits with it however much we want to. But really, we're probably just rehashing the same fundamental objections that we may have to it, or the fundamental supports that we may have for it, absent of what CCI and CCI is going to say about its own efforts. You know, from one perspective, hey, it's better than the litigation that the content industry was engaged in 10, 11 years ago. You know, the mass lawsuits against individuals accused of trading content through peer-to-peer networks online. You know, it's better than that. You know, then there are the things that we don't like it. But again, these are just the criticisms we would have, or the commentary we would have otherwise, regardless of what they're saying. You know, we could see why the content industry may like it, and a reason for consumers not to like it, because content industry is getting a real boon here to have some of the expenses of these administrative costs of enforcement and monitoring and policing shifted over onto the ISPs. And, you know, who's paying for that? I got some news for you. You know who's paying for that. Right. So it always goes down to the consumer. So, you know, those are just the same critiques we can have. And I think when we have an announcement from CCI as to its success without any real data to go on, we just like, okay, fine, whatever. And we just rehearse the same commentary we have about it that we've had about it from the first hearing about it a couple of years ago.
Right. And I still am very anxious to find in the wild and talk to or read about somebody who's gone through the appeal system, you know, where they have mandatory arbitration if you're challenging a notice. I anecdotally have not heard of anyone who's done that yet. So if you're that person or...
You can't afford the $35 to...
Right, exactly. So I'd like to hear how that's working.
You know, to Evan's point, given the fact that no one's actually had to deal with responding to one of these or investigating or handling one of them, you know, that's mm-hmm. often the people who can claim the most success, right?
Right. All right. Another quick update on something we covered last year, and that is, you remember Professor Lessig's open video where he's showing all the clips of people. I think that they are mimicking a scene from The Breakfast Club to the song Listomania. He uses that to illustrate a point in his lecture that he actually was sued for that by the Australian entity that holds the rights to that particular song, Listomania. and got EFF on his side and litigated it and fought it and was arguing in the case. The interesting aspect of this case it was a Section 512F case where they were claiming that the DMCA takedown notice was not, as Neil was talking about earlier, well thought through, and that as a result, under the statute, some penalties should apply. The update there is that Professor Lessig and, let's see, Liberation Media is the Australian music label that owned the rights to the Phoenix song Listomania. The parties amicably have settled this case. The settlement is, I don't think the amount of the settlement has been disclosed, but some of the terms have. Liberation is updating its copyright policies with respect to fair use. EFF is getting some money that it's going to dedicate to supporting its work on open access.
I think it was $100 billion.
I don't think it was quite that much. But I just wanted to bring you up to speed on that in case you missed it. That I think at the time we were much amused by the fact that someone would send a DMCA takedown notice to Professor Lawrence Lessig and expect him not to fight it to the full extent possible. Neil, any thoughts on this?
I've always kind of wondered if it was a setup. You know, it was just they wanted to get an issue out there. But that's the conspiracy theorist in me.
I love it.
Why not? Yeah. Who doesn't love a good conspiracy theory? Let's see. I think that's all our updates under this Hollywood entertainment section. What we haven't talked about yet, and I'd like to, although we're kind of coming into the last part of the show, especially because it kind of plays in, at least with an IRC comment, to the Getty story we discussed. Someone in IRC asked whether Getty had gone ahead and gotten releases from all the stock photography models, which is another issue that we've talked about on the show before when that has come up. This Innocence of Muslims film has that kind of issue involved and resulted in a very strange Ninth Circuit decision that I have yet to sort of square up in my own mind and come to terms with. The impact here, the Ninth Circuit decided that an actress in the Innocence of Muslims film had the wool pulled over her eyes. It was sort of, I want to say, kind of a fraud in the inducement kind of problem here, where she thought she was acting in one film. Her name, the plaintiff in the case, is Cindy Lee Garcia. She believed she was acting in a film called Desert Warrior and not this very offensive film that became the finished product and has raised a lot of ire around the world. So what the court found was that she never validly gave a release or consent to being in this film, and that she therefore retains a copyright interest in her performance and could validly send a DMCA takedown notice and have the film removed. Now, Google's very up in arms about this. And filed an emergency motion that I believe was denied, although they did get confirmation from the court that if they edited out the plaintiff's performance, then they could repost what was previously on YouTube. Have you guys taken a look at this? And Neil, have you managed to wrap your head around it yet?
It's one of those cases of bad facts makes unbelievably bad law. I mean, I can't think of it any mm-hmm. other way. And I mean, mm-hmm. you know, there's some real, real troublesome facts in this case that I think drove an outcome. But I can't imagine the broad reaching legal principles that people are holding it out for ultimately stand up. The one thing I'll say is that the entertainment law firms around here that are doing transactional work, I think they're all really excited and happy because it means they're going to be able to generate lots of billings by having to go out and get new documentation on releases and the like.
Yeah, exactly. A little cottage industry there. Evan, I know Professor Goldman thinks this is one of the worst things to come out of the Ninth Circuit in a very long time. It's authored by Chief Judge Kaczynski, who's usually kind of spot on in his analyses, or at least entertaining to read. I think this was a struggle for him, though. Do you have any take on this?
Well, I think we all need to be a little bit careful about our indignation when it comes to this, and we need to be critical about the indignation of others when we're talking about this case. You know, immediately everybody was saying, and by everybody I mean like EFF and the expected crowd, was saying, oh, this is awful, terrible, miscarriage of justice, blah, blah, blah. Judge Kaczynski made a big error in all this. I really think that if we're going to be angry at anybody in this situation where bad facts have made bad law, we don't want to be angry at the judge. We don't be angry at the court, the Ninth Circuit. I think that the Ninth Circuit may very well have come to the right conclusion here. You know, let's not be so quick to join in with Google's indignation about this, because, you know, sure, Google is, you know, Google's awesome and all that, and Fred Von Lohman's our friend, you know, or the copyright lawyer over there and all that stuff. But Google, at the end of the day, Google doesn't give a rat's behind about substantive copyright issues, but except to the extent that it's going to affect their bottom line. They don't want to be troubled with having to deal with the administrivia of having to actually, you know, police taking down a greater number of audiovisual works than what they have to already, based on claims like this one that we see here, where it's one participant in a work. There's this question of whether or not it was a joint work, whether or not she can claim authorship and the whole thing, you know. So what that leads us to, the person we need to be angry about here, and this isn't the only context in which I guess people have been angry at him, is the director or the producer or whomever it was who failed to go through the formalities of doing it the right way, of playing by the rules of the game to make it clear that the copyright rights are transferred from the participant to the producer, the one who's actually going to be trying to exploit those rights. So sure, we can lament this. It's lamentable, but we need to be careful in articulating why it's lamentable. And unlike many other commentators, I don't think it's lamentable because of what the court did. I think the court did the best it could. Judge Kaczynski, I can't point to where he was wrong in his analysis. We shouldn't be angry at the actress. You know, whether we like it or not, we have intellectual property rights in this country. And she was, I think most reasonable people would do the same thing if they were receiving death threats. So, and you know, we can kind of be skeptical of Google's motives in all of its hand waving and hand wringing and all this, but let's you know, keep in perspective why they're doing that, and maybe ultimately their interests are the same as ours. But let's not let that cloud our real judgment as to how we should think about the substantive copyright issues.
Neil, do you think that before the cottage industry of making sure releases are more ironclad than they maybe have been in the past takes hold, you know, for the body of films that exist to date, do you really see that this case is going to result in a floodgate opening of plaintiffs saying, hey, that film didn't quite come out the way that I thought that it would, and so I'm going to assert my copyright interest as well?
Right. Everyone who's ever won a Raspberry Award for making like the crappiest film of the year all of a sudden wants to take it offline, right?
Right.
So, you know, I think Evan's right. I mean, you know, at some level, there's also going to be the whole group of people that are going to go and look through whatever their agreements are and see if they had the same problems that that the agreements here had. And maybe they do, maybe they don't. But it does seem like there's going to be some studying of, you know, can I even assert a claim here in light of what I've already given up for the deal? And I don't think there's going to be a floodgates of thousands and thousands of cases, but there'll probably be some. You might see a slight uptick in the number of DMCA notices sent out and things like that. But yeah, I'm not a fan of the decision. I think it overstates some of the law. I think that it's going to be limited to its facts at some point. But, you know, I don't think that, you know, we're going to all of a sudden see thousands and thousands of new claims raised under this somewhat screwy fact pattern.
What's Google's argument to the Supreme Court for cert going to look like, since we don't have a circuit split?
And I don't represent Google, so I can talk about this.
Right.
You know, I think Google's, you know, cert petition is going to, you know, look something like at what point is somebody's contributions merely a contribution, and you're looking at the copyright work as a whole? And where does the proprietary interest of an individual end in these much larger compilations? You know, I mean, these sorts of issues have garnered some interest. They actually started when people started talking about things like music sampling and what rights exist in music sampling, when you might have 300 samples of different songs in a particular song of some sort. But you know, I'm not sure the Supreme Court's really been confronted with that question before, of, you know, how is it that compilations work, and then when you have an actor whose performance is only being recorded in a tangible medium by somebody else who has a proprietary interest, you know, how does that work? I think it's something that the Supreme Court could find interesting, as far as, you know, where does the copyright interest begin and who holds it?
All right. Well, a couple of fun little things here at the end. I know from having listened to you on Adam Carolla, Neil, that you were involved in the Facebook litigation against the Winklevii. I thought it might be fun just to check in with them and reconfirm that their faith in Bitcoin is strong despite the Mt. Gox bankruptcy and folding, et cetera, that happened. I understand too that they're buying tickets to space with Bitcoin.
I read that story too, and yeah. You know, I personally, and you know, I'll just say this in jest. I always thought they were kind of out in space, but
yeah.
but you know, but look, you know, look, that Bitcoin is going to have its roller coaster ride, right? I mean. It's an unregulated thing, and some people are going all in on it. I think the Winklevii have more or less gone all in on it. I can't say I really understand Bitcoin, but it is a pretty awesome thing that they can use Bitcoin to buy tickets to space. I can't say it another way. I think it's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it's like the internet exploded at that point.
Right. My head exploded too, but sure. Yeah.
But the other thing that I loved just about this duo of stories is the whole, I don't know if you guys saw John Stewart on Mt. Gox when it began to fold, but he did a hysterical segment on it and pointed out that Mt. Gox actually started life as the Magic the Gathering online exchange. So it did a little pivot there into trading in Bitcoin. Love that.
Natural pivot, though.
Yeah, exactly. We've got drones that a judge had ruled legal. Commercial drones. Sort of leapfrogging the FAA who doesn't plan to promulgate rules on that until 2015. There's a story by Adrian Jeffries over at The Verge talking about the dismissal of a $10,000 fine levied by the FAA against a Swiss drone operator who used a camera drone at the University of Virginia campus for commercial purposes, apparently, but getting back to our non-commercial versus commercial difficulty. There's that perhaps courts are going to undo FAA regulations against these things. Here we at least have one judge who's decided that a fine should be tossed out. Evan, do you think that we will see, you know, can I call up pizza and get it delivered by drone tonight?
I mean, if we can't even deliver beer to ice fishermen, I think we've still got a few more hurdles to cross on this. I was a little confused about what was going on and whether this was a story or a non-story, because the holding of the court was, you know, what FAA regulations were in place at the time of the incident. And I didn't go ahead and actually get to the bottom of it, but I got the suspicion that this was more of just a kind of a alignment of timing and what was really there, and that it wasn't necessarily a you know, a tantamount to a repeal of the FAA's order. So, you know, I should probably just leave it at that and not perpetuate anybody else to have any more misunderstandings about it. So, but yeah. I get the sense there's a little bit of a technicality thing here that's going to maybe make this not as breathtaking as what we would hope it would be.
Yeah, I have the feeling you're right. Neil, you're right there at Startup Central in Menlo Park. You get a lot of people coming into the office saying, I really want to start delivering things by drone. When can I do this?
So there's this one company I love, and it's a company called AnyBot. And I don't know if you guys ever talked about them online before, but they have these little drones that act as receptionists for offices. And so when you walk into the office, it has a face, but the face has a person – has a screen with a person's face on it that's like some really, really far location away. And this I call it a drone. I'm not sure exactly what you would call it, but it greets you with this face of a person who's God knows where, and it escorts you through the office to wherever you're going to go. And my immediate reaction when I saw that was, I really need one of those.
did you see the episode of the Big Bang Theory where Sheldon had a shell bot? He hung out in his bedroom and sent it to work, etc.
So, you know, there are a lot of people trying to come up with new and better ways to facilitate, you know, localized delivery, whether it's through drones or I heard a rumor that Uber was now having an ice cream delivery service. I don't know if that's true or not. But basically, you know, the Uber drivers, when they're not doing anything, they can pick up ice cream, bring it to your house. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I had heard. But these are
if it's not true, they must do it. That's just the best idea I've ever heard.
It is pretty awesome. And so, you know, we hear lots of people talking about these sorts of things. I'm not sure that I've seen a whole lot that's kind of ready quite yet.
One other California decision I've been meaning to point out, because we talk a lot about driving technology and, you know, whether you can drive with Google Glass and other things. A California appellate court has held that someone looking at the maps on their phone, that was okay, that didn't violate the distracted driving laws in California. Now, California has a separate you can't text and drive law. But the court seemed to think that these laws were enacted before phones were able to do all of these other functions besides simply making phone calls. And here's the poll quote. Had the legislature intended to prohibit drivers from holding the telephone and using it for all purposes, it would not have limited the telephone's required design and configuration to hand-free listening and talking, but would have used broader language such as hands-free operation or hands-free use. So it went on to conclude that yes, if you're needing to navigate by looking at a map on your phone, at least according to this California appellate court, that's okay in our state. So I thought that was interesting because we seem to see, I think, more and more a move for courts and legislatures to want to keep people away from their phones in the car. And this seemed to be a loosening of that. Neil, did you take a look at this?
I did. And, I kind of thought of it as, you know, some old guy in his car saying, well, what's the difference between me using a map on my phone and just mm-hmm. using the nav system in my car? And it seems to be overreaching to say that, you know, you can't, or on a Garmin device that you might mount in your car. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought there was an element of that in kind of the analysis. I'm just kind of, you know, people use navigation systems and all sorts of different handheld devices. What's so magical about a phone that makes us want to transform, you know, something that's really to stop people from talking on the phone, whether it's through, you know, typing or actually talking live. In a way that they're distracted, to a utility that exists in cars today and has before these sorts of phone functionalities existed.
So, Evan, do you think this is just an example of California being crazy and we shouldn't encourage people to be distracted?
Yeah, thanks for just going ahead and saying it for me. I mean, if I got into the nuances of every little crazy little thing in you all in California and your legislature, you know, yeah, it'd be much more messed up, you know, than the way life is already for me. So, yeah, you know, it's a situation where technology or the laws have to continue to keep pace with technology and enact definitions and restrictions that are meaningful in terms of how things are advancing and the more gadgets we have that can do more things.
All right, so we'll make California crazy our second. Oh, there we go. We've got a telepresence bot roaming around the studio.
And Cash Hill was riding around or walking around in one of those CES.
Now hey, what's your name?
Josh.
Hi, Josh.
I'm Josh. I work here.
I'm your new pal.
Hey.
My name's Leobot.
It's like you're actually right here.
Yeah. Yeah, I am right here. So what are you doing?
I'm just hanging out, you know, editing.
Yeah. Show me your editing booth.
Uh-oh.
I have to go home now.
Was there echo because Leo was just right over in his office as the bot was rolling around, Alex?
Yeah, that was it.
So
I need one of those to go to court for me sometimes.
Yeah. Maybe someday. You never know. California Crazy will be our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And we will move on to our tips and resources of the week. Evan, we're going to make the tip another of your posts on internet cases having to do with confidential settlements and what one should do after one has been entered into a confidential settlement, that is, and having one's daughter go on social media and say, we won, so suck it, is probably not what you want to do.
No, I mean, this is a story that, you know, this is one of those stories about social media that people love hearing, you know, love seeing the misfortune of others writ large. And, you know, there's going to be some interesting family dynamics to work out here. But, you know, as you were saying, long story short version of it is dad reached a settlement in a lawsuit that had a confidentiality provision that allowed him to disclose it to his spouse. And if he violated the confidentiality provision, he had to forfeit $80,000 of the settlement money. Well, within a week or so after the settlement agreement was signed, the language of the court was the ink hadn't even dried on the settlement agreement yet. The daughter, the college-age daughter, posted something like, you know, mama and papa, you know, one big against plaintiff or against defendant. So defendant, and I'm inserting names, you know, a defendant is paying for my European vacation this summer. So suck it. And so they saw that and, you know, the defendant brought that to the attention of the court. Well, I guess the way it got to the court is the defendant refused to pay. So the plaintiff then brought it to the court trying to enforce the settlement agreement. The court said, you know what? You violated that confidentiality provision. We're siding with the defendant here. They don't have to pay you that $80,000. So the iteration of the headline is Facebook post costs dad $80,000. People love that stuff. You've seen that whole motif in the headline. Yes. It's even gotten some attention in the mainstream media. So yeah, the tip is keep your mouth shut.
Yeah, exactly. Kids and social media, what are we going to do with them? You said you've handled cases, Neil, where folks have wound up in juvenile hall for their social media posts.
Yeah. I probably shouldn't talk about the juvenile cases, but certainly, you know, it's amazing how social media posts are thought to be confidential and they're not. Go ahead.
It's just a recurring theme on the show. It comes up over and over again.
Yeah, I think it's just a very ironic thing that, you know, when folks are taking pictures on their phone and putting them online, somehow they think that, you know, that they're not taking pictures of themselves and putting them online.
Right. The resource of the week I pulled out is from our friends at the EFF. It is their Legislative Solutions for Patent Reform. It's a whole sort of primer. If you are someone who's interested in patent reform, of things that they think are a good idea, things that show up in various ways in the transparency bill that we discussed on today's show, also in the Innovation Act, things like fee shifting, end user immunity, transparency, disclosure, effective post-grant review of patents and functional claiming, which Neil was discussing. So if you want to learn more about what those things are and why they're a good idea as far as patent reform is concerned, EFF has a nice guide to that. Neil, anything to add?
One thing to add to it is, you know, there are a lot of really good blogs out there about various things going on in the IP world. For people that that follow these sorts of things, either, you know, the EFF obviously has a lot of resources for their own advocacy that are terrific. Patent Leo is another one that's really popular. There are a couple really good ones that are particular to particular jurisdictions, like the Eastern District of Texas and Delaware. My firm runs a trade secrets blog as well as a IP specific blog for the Northern District of California, which is where we live, as well as Central District, which is Los Angeles. Those are other helpful resources in addition to some of the stuff that that the EFF has out there.
Right. Interesting that you say that someone would, you know, do a blog on just the Eastern District of Texas. But there's at least one of those, the Eastern Texas weblog.com one. And I'm sure probably a few more covering that particular hotbed of patent litigation. Good to keep an eye on that. And for the EFF guide and all the other stories that we've talked about today, our list of those things for you to come back and refer to is at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/249. And with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this show. It's been great having this wonderful and wide-ranging discussion with you, Neil Chatterjee. Tell us what's going on at ORIC and in your practice group these days that you might want people to know more about. We've got your trade secret blog. Anything else?
Well, we have two other blogs that we run, the Northern District of California blog and the Central District of California, which are really reporting on IP decisions out of our area, or one of our areas, which is Northern California and Southern California. Appreciate the opportunity to be on the show today. It's really been a lot of fun, and it's always fun to talk about cool internet stuff and cool patent law stuff. We are doing some of the stuff on the forefront of patent law and internet law. So there's a lot of interesting things coming down the pike. I could tell you about it, but I'd have to kill you. So stay tuned. Hopefully you see us in the news.
We'll look for you and your Viking helmet and your spam can and or hammer to light the way for us.
Right. And people, Evan, can friend me on. Oh, I'm sorry. People can friend me on Facebook too, because I do view that as a competition. So always welcome new friends.
Well, they cap you, don't you? Or do you get special dispensation that you can have as many friends as you'd like?
They don't give me special dispensation, but I still have a ways to go on the cap, unfortunately. I think it's because I just don't have as many friends as I'd like.
Aw, well, we'll try and do something about that. and you can make up for Evan, who's not on Facebook at all. So you can have all his friends.
Right.
Well, that would be great.
You can think about me driving my horse and buggy while you're on Facebook. Yep, that's how I am.
So. Yep. Yahoo. And not looking at your phone for directions at the time.
No.
So great chatting with you, Evan, as usual. Anything going on with you these days that we should know about?
Thawing out, getting ready for spring here. Got a couple of conferences, events at the Chicago Bar Association. I'm, you know, assuming the Mt. Gox thing doesn't do away with Bitcoin altogether, I'm going to be speaking on Bitcoin in June. So kind of getting some, you know, getting my foundation set for that. So other than that, you know, just kind of, you know, spending a lot of time in the salt mines, trying to help clients and just, you know, all around do the right thing. So, you know, it's the good life.
Yes. Toiling in the vineyards of justice, as one of my old partners always used to say.
I like that better. It's much, you know, a little different connotation than a salt mine.
Yeah. Well, keep stomping the grapes. And we will be back here next week, Evan and I, with new guests for you to become edified from. That's going to be at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when we record the show live. If you can't join us live, don't worry about it. You can go to twit.tv/twill. You can find the episode that we are recording here today and all of our past episodes there in the archives. If you're a YouTube person, you can find our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. You can subscribe to us in iTunes or any other way that you like to consume this kind of entertainment. And what else? We definitely love for you to get in touch with us between the shows. That's how we learn about new and interesting people who Evan and I might not be acquainted with already, who we should have on the show. We love your suggestions for guests, and we love your suggestions for topics and your feedback and critique of things that we've already discussed on the show. So either email us, I'm Denise at twit.tv, Evan is Evan at twit.tv, or go on over to Facebook where you can friend up the This Week in Law show at the same time that you're joining the Neil Chatterjee posse. We've got a page over there, and also on Google+ where we hash out issues before the shows. So we really appreciate your joining us today. And every week on This Week in Law, we have a blast looking at all these issues that just never seem to go away. Technology throws a wrench into the law and vice versa. And it's our great pleasure to try and make heads or tails of it. So we're glad you've joined us here today doing that. And we'll see you next week. Take care.